Good morning. We are ready for the first case of this morning, United States against Allen. Mr. Leek.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Timothy Leek, and I represent Defendant Appellant Anthony Allen. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The government did not present sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Allen was guilty of the burglary of a Standard Federal Bank in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And even if this court believes that there was sufficient evidence, Allen should be afforded a new trial based upon the erroneous and prejudicial admission of a photograph of him at the scene and of the prejudicial testimony of the government shoe print expert witness.
Mr. Leek, is that photograph in the record on appeal?
I believe it has been. It is part of the exhibits to the trial court, and which were cited to and discussed in all of the briefs.
Yeah, I realized it was certainly before the trial court, but we didn't find it in the record on appeal. I'm not sure if it was designated. Maybe you could double check that and
I will double check
for the government as well. And if it is not, take the appropriate steps to make it part of this record?
I will do that.
Because it's very difficult for us, obviously, to evaluate anything about whether this was an unofficial photograph or not, based only on people's descriptions of it.
I understand that. Because my time is limited, I would like to discuss the photograph, if possible, and focus on that improper admission. The photograph, there is a grave risk of introducing photographs and other evidence where other evidence is available that show the accused is a person who committed a crime. In this case, the government had absolutely no need for the photograph. They had several descriptions of the perpetrator of the crime from several police officers, two at the scene and two later on where Mr. Allen was arrested.
But where is the rule that says the government can't, for example, prove what clothes he was wearing in a couple of different ways? At worst, it seems to me that might be cumulative, but I didn't know that was a reason actually to exclude evidence as a matter of law.
The reason to exclude it in this case is due to the highly prejudicial nature of the photograph, and as Your Honor made aware this morning, you have not been able to see that photograph, and I apologize for that. I will get that in there. But this photograph does depict Mr. Allen standing in front of a police car with his hands behind his back, obviously in custody at the scene of the crime. And as it may be cumulative evidence, this evidence, based upon the totality of the circumstances, the rest of the testimony, the breaks in the chain of identification, this photograph is highly what the jury would look at and based upon. This was much too prejudicial of a photograph to be admitted.
Maybe you could, you have standard of review issues, of course, as I know you're aware, with all of the arguments you're making. This one would be surmounting the abuse of discretion, and actually the photograph, too, was not objected to, per se.
That is correct.
Yeah, so plain error there, and as well, plain error with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence. Maybe it would be helpful for you to talk about why, on your first argument, the sufficiency argument, you think there's enough here to constitute plain error.
The sufficiency of the evidence, there just isn't enough there. The first off...
Well, what about, let's take it element by element. Is there any evidence that the trier of fact could have credited that Mr. Allen was in the bank, he entered or attempted to enter the bank?
There are no fingerprints inside the bank. In fact, the evidence shows that the police officer who saw the perpetrator of the bank, of bank burglary, placed his hand on a glass window and thus said left fingerprints. Those fingerprints taken were conclusively not Mr. Allen. There are no surveillance photos. There are nothing from the inside of the bank which would put Mr. Allen in that bank. There was testimony that the bank vault was open and there was cement dust all over the place, like a bomb had gone off. There was no testimony whatsoever of any cement dust on Mr. Allen's clothes, which the government did have. The government relied on the identification of police officer, Officer Hopkins, who saw a perpetrator inside the bank, but even that identification testimony is highly suspect. Officer Hopkins, who had many years of experience on the force, described the perpetrator as 6 foot tall. Mr. Allen is 6 foot four, and when Officer Hopkins saw the perpetrator, he was 7 feet away. 4 inches, 4 to 5 inches, and seven feet away is very significant in terms of a police officer with a lot of experience.
But you had the footprint in the bank.
I was just getting to
that. Right.
The footprint is inconclusive, and the government in its brief admittedly said there's not enough characteristics on that footprint to make a positive identification. The government's expert testimony, which basically said it was inconclusive. It maybe could have. Maybe could have, maybe not. The footprint was a Nike Air shoe. There are thousands upon thousands of Nike Airs shoes being made and worn. There was no testimony whatsoever to narrow the scope of any possible people wearing that shoe. It just seems that the government trying to extrapolate that this half a footprint, which had another footprint on top of it, was missing half the shoe, was enough to convict a person from inside where they didn't narrow the scope of any potential people. And that is where I would like to get back, and that testimony is highly prejudicial and should not have been allowed. The government's witness could not conclusively give any sort of opinion on this matter. And
well, the problem surely isn't with footprint evidence in general. The government put on various experts to talk about how this is done, I'll say generically. It surely has to be something more specific if there's any problem at all.
Well, there's 2 points on that. The first one is, I don't know, I would not concede that the methodology of footprint in general would necessarily be admissible. There is no ascertainable standard there for an expert to testify to. Unlike the trial court compared it a lot to fingerprint. It's impression evidence as well, but fingerprints have the Galton point system where there's, you know, 5 or 6 points, and you can have a match after meeting that ascertainable standard.
But why isn't it possible that somebody might choose to become an expert in the different designs at the bottom of shoes? I mean, I can certainly imagine somebody, say, with cars, being able to identify distinctive grills on cars or distinctive taillights or what have you, if that happens to be that person's interest. What's different about shoes?
I wouldn't necessarily argue that there would be anything preventing somebody from going and studying the bottom parts of shoes. However, when it comes to admitting it at trial and an expert, we need to have, under the Daubert standard, there has to be some sort of reliability on that analysis and that conclusion. And in this case, there is, or in shoe print methodology in general, there is no ascertainable standard there. It is solely up to the opinion of the examiner. There was testimony at the trial court level regarding the ability and the methodology of a verification process to basically try and bring in that reliability. You know, this is my opinion, let's have a second opinion and see if they agree. But that would bring up my second point on the footprint. There was no verification in this case. It was strictly Mr. Pittston, the government's expert testimony, it was strictly his opinion.
Well, aren't the techniques for shoe print identification generally accepted in the forensic community? And aren't those techniques subject to peer review?
Well, I think the argument on that is the government presented that there were several magazine articles regarding shoe print testimony. But in terms of subject to peer review, I guess I would submit to the court as well that without this ascertainable standard, it's just one subjective opinion after another. You could have three different people look at it, have three different opinions, and without having a common system where they could say, because there are six or seven matches or 10 matches like fingerprints, it's just one subjective opinion after another. And therefore, I would submit that, no, there really is no peer review. There is no ascertainable error rate in this as well, because it is purely subjective.
But here, don't we have, like, standard kind of shoes and different models of shoes that experts can compare, so at least we can know the model of shoe? Isn't that a distinction between fingerprints where everybody's fingerprint is unique? I mean, I'm just questioning whether you need to have that kind of standard that you're suggesting should be applicable.
My answer to that would be is yes, there are different molds and there are different types of shoes, and shoes come from different factories, and there could be...
And there are standards, certainly, that are supposed to be met for the shoes. I mean, and then you have to make a big assumption that, you know, the same shoe is produced the same way, same kind of ridges and that kind of thing.
Exactly. And I guess that assumption is, even though there are different molds and there are standards for those shoes, without an examination, the examination, as I understand it, it's a side-by-side, and you look for cuts and scrapes and molds of shoe. It's just one of the things you look at in terms of trying to make the identification. And
I thought your basic point was that at that level, the jury could also, a layperson, could also see if there was a, you know, if the rubber had gotten cut in a certain place on a on the bottom of the shoe.
Exactly, and that is definitely an item that's within the realm of the jury.
But the trial court disagreed with you and did see, as Judge Williams is pointing out, that maybe it's just a level of knowledge about all of these things, realizing that you should look for particular characteristics of certain shoe brands. Why not let the evidence in for whatever it's worth? Let it go to the weight and cross-examination, which is exactly what the judge said to do.
Well, I think it's the second half of the Daubert standard there.
If you want to save your rebuttal time.
I would like to save my rebuttal time. Thank you very much.
Okay, sure. Thank you. We'll hear now from Mr. Miller.
Thank you. My name is David Miller. I'm the assistant U.S. attorney that tried this case at the trial court level. This case involved a kind of a circumstantial case, but not really.
Oh, it's a circumstantial case. I try to
understand. It's kind of a circumstantial case.
I have several questions for you, Mr.
Yes,
Miller,
ma'am.
Including, it would help me a lot if you would begin by specifying exactly what evidence you think was before the trier of fact to show that Mr. Allen was in the bank with intent to commit a felony. What intent evidence do you have? What, if anything, do you have, even if we bought your shoe print evidence that he was in the bank, even if we bought the identification evidence, what's the evidence of intent?
First of all, what happened was Officer Hopkins had worked at this bank as a...
Well, I know that, but I would like you to answer the intent.
The intent question will go to the fact that the ATM was pried open, tried to get into.
So how do we know the ATM is associated with Mr. Allen? The ATM is off in the...
ATM is inside the building. The ATM is inside the bank.
So if I've been inside the bank, I committed robbery too? I had intent?
No.
All the people in the bank had an intent to damage the ATM machine.
It's 11:30 at night to begin with.
Fine.
The bank is not open to the general public. The testimony was that the bank wasn't in a condition that it was in when the officers arrived. That is, the doors hadn't been ripped off, the cement hadn't been chiseled down off of a vault door. The ATM machine had been attempted to pry open the machine to get money out of it. Testimony was there was $25,000 that was in that machine. Up to $125,000 was in a vault in the bank. In this particular case, the vault that they attempted to open ended up being a supply vault. what they had to do was they peeled off a metal layer. Inside was cement. They took chisels and
Whoever the they is,
the they is Mr. Allen.
No, we don't know that. I mean, that's, well, you're arguing that it was Mr. Allen. We have no idea, of course.
Well, Mr. Allen was inside the bank.
Well, we don't know that. That's
well, the testimony is that a person that fit Mr. Allen's description when he was caught was inside the bank.
How many people in Indianapolis fit Fort Mr. Wayne. Allen, or sorry, Fort Wayne, how many people in Fort Wayne fit the description of an African-American man wearing dark jogging clothes?
I don't know how many people would fit that description. The question would be how many people fit at 11:30 at night within 15 to 20 minutes after the bank was burglarized, and a person with that description is running out of the back of the bank.
Well,
that would be my question.
We don't know if the person, if Mr. Allen was that same person, because there's no continuous sight line of the person who runs out of the back of the bank finally to these apartments.
I think the evidence in the record shows that Officer Hopkins, when he came through the door, Officer Hopkins chased him. He fell down. The man was heading east. A citizen was going up a parallel street and saw a male black, same description, height, weight, clothing, run across his path right into this apartment complex. Police Officer Freeze, who was also setting up a perimeter in the area, in the apartment complex, saw a male black, same height, same description, same clothing, walking and then running between the apartment complex. They called to him, "Stop, police." He continued to run. They yelled again, "Stop, police." He continued to run until he ran into a thicket of bushes where he couldn't go any further. And at that point in time, he was detained and arrested.
And why is it that his fingerprints are not on the glass that the officer saw him put his hands on?
The officer saw him put his hands on this glass, but the record is that when he was captured, he had on his hands full leather gloves. So when he turned to hit to go out and hit the glass, and Officer McCann said, "I couldn't see what was on his hands," he didn't leave any prints because he had gloves on his hands inside the bank. And when he was captured,
and the gloves are still inside the bank, even though they're also on his hand.
No, ma'am.
There are gloves in the bank.
Yes, ma'am, there are. On Mr. Allen, there were black leather gloves. Inside the bank were brown Thinsulate gloves that were found inside there. Mr. Allen had on black leather gloves.
And how do we know that there are two pairs of gloves? I mean, why would there be? Why would a person have two pairs of gloves?
Well, there were, in our opinion, two people. There was another individual sitting in the woods, and when Officer Hopkins was looking at the back door, this person popped up and ran away. When they came back and searched that area, there was the pry bars,
right,
sledgehammers, etc., where that individual was. So presumably there were two people in the bank. One got out and the other guy didn't get out. And by the time the police arrived, he tried to get out. Couldn't get out the front door, couldn't get out the back door, and finally just broke through the door and ran. And the officers gave chase, citizens saw him, dog tracked.
The dog, let's not do the dog track because they abandoned that. The dog track is inconclusive.
They didn't abandon the track. The track ended about 80 feet from where he was because it was on pavement.
Well, that's the right point. I mean, the dog doesn't alert to him. The dog track doesn't finish with an alert on him.
The dog did not finish where he was.
That
is correct. The dog did track to where he went.
I can't imagine, though, that the dog track is evidence that a rational trier of fact could use in finding this beyond a reasonable doubt, identifying this man.
That is just one piece of evidence, Your Honor.
Well,
the other piece of evidence is Officer Freeze. The other piece of evidence is Officer Hopkins, in terms of who came out of the back of the bank, who chased him, the evidence with the citizen who saw a person, same height.
Well, not quite the same height, of course, since there's a 4-inch difference. And one of the officers who identifies him purports to identify him when he's sitting down in the car. It's kind of hard to identify the height of people when they're sitting down.
Well, one of the officers, that was Officer Hopkins, came back. But he was the officer that was at the rear of the bank when the person came out of the bank.
With the ski mask on.
That is correct. With the ski mask on, who was upright and running at that point in time. That is correct. he was running. And I think the evidence was, with regard to Officer Egan or one of the other officers, that he was 6'1 to 6'2 and not merely 6 foot. But you have to keep in mind also, it was 11:30 at night, it was dark, and they gave chase on this individual. When he ran to the front of the building, I think it was Officer McCann that said he was 6'1 to 6'2, when he ran to the front of the building and tried to get out, then made a turn to go out. This all happened in split-second time with regard to how tall he was, and these are really estimates of how tall he was. So 6'1 to 6'4, I don't believe is an unreasonable estimate given the circumstances of this case.
And what about the fact that your expert really couldn't say this was the same shoe? This is quite different from a lot of cases where shoe print evidence is used to say there are distinctive characteristics of a shoe that was worn. This print shows those characteristics. I would have no trouble with the idea that an expert could testify in that fashion. This is just a Nike Air?
No, this is the same type of shoe, had the same characteristics of thousands of other shoes. That's
right.
Correct.
So why is this probative?
It's probative because inside the bank, in the dust, is the same, at 11:30 at night, is the same type of shoe pattern that's there that the defendant had that was caused 15 minutes later.
But yet the defendant has no cement dust on him.
That defendant may not have cement dust on him.
How could he have made the shoe print without any cement dust?
Maybe he's not the person that's chipping out the cement. Maybe it's the guy that got away.
His foot in the cement dust.
The cement dust was on top of the vault door, and when he was leaving, he stepped on it going out. It wasn't. That's the impression that was left. It was on top of the vault door that was now on the ground, and he stepped on it, and that's where the impression was found.
Right, and Judge Wood's point was, why wasn't there residue of cement dust, albeit one step? Why wasn't there some residue on the bottom of the
door? Oh, I'm sorry. I got cement on the clothes on the bottom of the shoe. Well, at that particular time, he ran through bushes, he ran through grass, he ran through bushes and grass. I assume that it came off with the distance that he ran. It was, I think it was October, November, I'll give my dates. But it was cool, 41 degrees.
October.
I assume that there was mist or pre-frost, I'll call it, on the grass when he was running, and certainly that dust of that nature could have come off the bottom of the shoe.
It was October 28th.
October 28th. With regard to the footwear impression evidence regarding the standards, my understanding that the standard is whether this trial court applied the Daubert framework, which it did in this case. And it made certain findings with regard to that. And then it had a second hearing to determine whether Officer Pitson, who was going to testify, was qualified and used that principle in his examination, which the court found that he in fact did. Once those factors are met, then the abuse of standard is the standard that must be met. And the government's position is that the defendant has certainly not met that standard in this particular case. I'll entertain any other questions that the court has.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. Mr. Leek? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Leek.
I just want to briefly finish answering that question that you had brought up before. As the government pointed out at the second hearing, whether or not the testimony, whether the methodology was followed, at this point I would say that there was no following the shoe print methodology that was set forth. There was no verification. And to answer your question on why it would be important to exclude this evidence based on the fact that a jury could make this determination and review the actual shoe prints and everything, and it's because of the prejudicial effect of the government trotting out a witness without really any opinion on this matter. It would just lend undue weight. The jury could very well be swayed by that point. And if there's any other further questions, Your Honor?
No, I think the case will be taken under advisement, and you have the thanks of the court, Mr. Leek, for serving.
Thank you.